WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new film, I Shot Andy Warhol, leaves you wanting to know more about the people who were part of the Warhol orbit. So on this archive edition, we have an interview with actress Mary Woronoff. She's written a memoir called Swimming Underground, My Years in the Warhol Factory. She dropped out of college in the mid-60s to dance and tour with the Velvet Underground and to appear in the Andy Warhol movie Chelsea Girls. Woronoff went on to act in several Roger Corman films, including Death Race 2000 and Hollywood Boulevard. She also co-starred in the film satires Eating Raoul and scenes from the class struggle in Beverly Hills. I spoke with her last year. She came from a middle-class family. Her father was a doctor. Her first connection to Warhol circle was poet Gerard Malanga, who she met when she was a student at Cornell University. She told me how she first saw Warhol's studio.
Cornell organized a class where we went to New York and we visited other artists' studio. And what happened is we went to Warhol's studio. And Warhol's studio was totally unlike anybody else's studio. The other studios were sort of like white boxes with lots of light and paintings on the walls. At Warhol, there were no paintings on the walls. The walls were covered with tinfoil, and it was dark, and it was weird. And there was stuff all over the place. It was messy. It was very evil-looking and chaotic-looking. And there were always people hanging around. Obviously, people who weren't, artists. I mean, they had nothing to do with art. They were just good-looking and hanging around and very moody-looking. And I don't know, I was attracted.
So you became a dancer with the Warhol show, The Exploding Plastic Inevitable. And you and Gerard Malanga used to dance to the Velvet Underground's performances.
Yes, that was, well, actually what happened is, the first thing that happened is I did a movie. And then I thought, well, this is fine. I have a job. You know, I'm going to do these movies for Warhol, for which I'm not paid. What a great job. I was very naive. And then added to what happened is the Barbara Rubin brought the Velvets in and they would play. And you know, Gerard was not one to give up a stage, so he would get up on the stage and start dancing, and I was with him, so I would get up on the stage and start dancing too. And it just became this, like, show. They put a movie in back of the Velvets, and we danced in front, and the Velvets played, and then Andy started moving it around as the Exploding Plastic Inevitable, and we went to California. But, I danced in front of them all the time. It was great. And we had these... Oh, I'm sorry.
I want you to describe the dances that you and Malanga did to the Velvets.
It's going to sound very strange, but, well, first of all, both of us are dressed in black leather by now, and both of us have, you know, whips. But it was definitely rock and roll dancing. It wasn't, Martha Graham-ish at all. It was rock and roll, but we would have all these different things like black lights and like those flickering strobe lights and crosses, and we would dance with these objects. Everybody there was very accustomed to happenings, as they were called then. You call them performances now. But doing things while you were dancing was nothing. I mean, it was considered fine. And Gerard and I were just very good together. We were very instinctive. So, you know, you dance, both of you have a whip, you know, you do all of these sort of, you know, pretend S&M things while you're dancing.
Like what?
Oh, he spent a lot of time on his knees, and he kissed the whip. Because, you know, in one of the songs it says, kiss the whip lightly. He would do that. And, we would just, it was actually very sexy what we did.
That song also says something about licking your shiny boots. Did he lick your boots, too?
A lot of kissing of boots and licking of boots. As a matter of fact, he made a whole movie of it. I didn't get to talk in that movie, obviously, but we were very young, and we just did things, you know? And nobody said no.
What was your favorite song to dance to?
My favorite song to dance to was Venus in Furs.
Kiss the boot of shiny, shiny leather. Shiny leather in the dark. Tongue the thongs, the belt that waiters await you. Strike, dear mistress, and cure his heart. Severin, Severin, speak so slightly. Severin, down on your bended knee. Taste the whip, in love not given lightly. Taste the whip, now bleed for me.
I guess it's Mary Warrenoff, and she's written a new memoir called Swimming Underground, My Years in the Warhol Factory. Well, the plastic exploding inevitable, the Warhol Roadshow, went to California, and it was a disaster there.
Yes.
What happened? Nobody came?
No. Well, there was one night where several people came, like Cher, and they all thumbed their noses at us. And then nobody came, and then they shut down the club that we were at, which was called The Trip. The reason why is because there was tremendous antagonism between New York and L.A. L.A. was, you know, full of color, full of acid, full of hippies, and we were not like that. We dressed in black and white. We did not like free love. We liked S&M and real restraint, perversion, too. We took amphetamine. They took LSD. They were, you know, sort of loving and happy, and we weren't really evil. We were more intellectual, more about art.
Most of the people in the Warhol crowd had a persona, you know, often a pose of some sort, or a transformed person who they became. Did you have a pose, a persona?
Yes.
What was it?
My pose at the time was unsexual, gender shifting into male, very powerful, very threatening.
Now, you describe yourself as asexual in your persona, yet the whip dance that you did was very much about sexual turn-on, so make those two add up for me.
I believe that, especially during Warhol, one of the sexiest things about that whole time was gender slipping. I do not think that it's unsexy. I think it's very sexy. A girl, well, first of all, I mean, the entire basis of Warhol's movies in the beginning was all of the drag queens, and they certainly were gender slippage, and they were certainly very, very sexy. A lot of art is about, you know, gender slippage, and that's what makes it sexy. That's what makes it interesting and attractive.
But you described yourself as having an asexual pose, and yet...
I did not come on flirty, you know, and want a lot of guys. I would pretend that I was a man. Not pretend that I was a man. I would act very masculine. And to see such pretty girl act very masculine was a turn-on. I mean, all I did was act, you know, sort of tough.
And you're about 6 feet tall, so you were imposing also.
Yes. Everybody posed. If you didn't pose, nobody saw you. It was a fight to get the biggest pose on. And that's what we liked, posing. I mean, you can't be around all of those queens and not think about posing every minute of the day. It was a language.
Was it tiring after a while to live in a pose? Or did you become that person?
Nothing was tiring. We were all on amphetamine. There wasn't tired.
But was it mentally exhausting to have to stay in a pose all the time? Or did you become the person?
No, you never become the person. I mean, the whole thing about our poses were they were completely ridiculous. I mean, first of all, half of those guys, you know, when they got dressed up as girls, they didn't do it like guys do it now. It was you know, totally dumb. They'd have runs in their stockings and, you know, runs in their hair. And it was about doing something that was not obviously not working, but pretending it is working to such an extent that everybody buys it. It was fun.
I think the thing that I found alarming reading your memoir was the time when you and a lot of the Warhol people were, I guess it was a party or a gathering of some sort, and one of the women there OD'd.
Yes.
And someone stretched her out on the table, and the party kind of continued.
Yes.
She was kind of like the centerpiece at the table.
We were so far gone that death didn't really enter in as this is a person and her life is gone. We weren't even thinking of her as a person.
She actually lived. She hadn't really died.
No, she hadn't. I mean, I didn't have that much experience with heroin, and apparently you look like you can go under and then you come back. And I didn't even know she was shot with heroin. So, we all thought she was dead.
At what point did you say to yourself, it is not human to behave this way? You know, something's terribly wrong. Yeah.
When I stopped taking drugs.
I mean, were you shocked when you looked back on that?
No, because I can remember how I felt. It was fine. And I didn't really get in trouble. I mean, you know, a lot of people get in trouble with drugs and they see people, you know, shot in the head and killed. And I was very, very protected.
Right.
But this was, the reason why this is in the book is because this was like, a slight error. You know, and I understand it was just really horrible, and thank God she did live, but it was like, a slight error. I mean, you know.
That's how far gone you all were.
Yeah. Yeah, we were really crazed on that one.
My guest is Mary Woronoff. She was in Andy Warhol's film Chelsea Girls. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Mary Woronoff, author of the memoir Swimming Underground, My Years in the Warhol Factory. I don't know if you saw this or not, but Victor Boukris, while writing about the life and death of Andy Warhol, quoted Gerard Malanga as saying, "Mary was someone I invented. I got a whip in her hand, spread her name around, made her a star, but she did not show any interest, and because of her passiveness, allowed herself to be eclipsed by Ingrid's superstar." What do you make of that?
Gerard is right. He definitely invented me. He found me at Cornell, and when he brought me to New York, I was definitely someone different. But I wanted that invention. I really loved that whole scene. I mean, he would suggest something, and I would go, yes. The reason why he says that I was passive and eclipsed is I was not interested in becoming a superstar. I was not interested in fighting for Edie Sedgwick's place. Fine, I would do a movie, but I was not interested in becoming a star. They loved girls to fight and, you know, to try and be stars, and I just would not take that place. If Ingrid wanted to pretend she was a star, fine, go let her. I refused to go into that game, and Gerard was furious with me because, rightfully so, I was the most talented. I was the one who, you know, understood what should be happening. Even Andy said this to me. But I just, you know, I didn't feel like fighting. I like the Queens. I like the whole drug scene. I just wanted to do what I wanted to do. I didn't, you know, if Andy sat down and then four girls tried to sit next to him, I'd walk the other way.
Now, you write in your book that this was a period when you didn't like sex.
No, I hated it.
I'm trying to figure out if I can ask you to explain why on the radio. What do you think?
For one thing, my parents didn't get along the way I thought someone should get along, so I definitely was against marriage. I was also, at the time, very young, and I was furious at the thought that I should be happy just being a wife with a man. That really infuriated me. I had floating rage about that one. The other thing is that I went to Cornell after being, you know, a virgin for a very long time. I did not have a great experience. I mean, you know, this apparently very nice kid, tried to go with me. And I was just so mad and so angry that it didn't work out. And instead of being upset, I said, okay, we're just going to make rules. And one of the rules is that, you know, sex just isn't in the game for me, and I just don't want it. And, you know, these other girls can, you know, go make fools of themselves, but for me, it's out. And I would do that, and then I would say, this is the way I'm going to lead my life. And until I met a giant stone wall, that's the way I did lead my life. I would always make up rules and say, this is the way it's going to be, and I'm going to do this, and I'm going to be different than everybody else.
I do find it really interesting that during this period when you were defiant about not having sex, that you were doing this very provocative whip dance, turning yourself on and everybody else.
No, I think it's really normal because you can't shut someone down when they're starting to peak with their hormones. I mean, I had to do something.
So it all came out in the dance?
Yes, it all came out in everything I did, everything I touched. I mean, I was a walking joke. You can't just shut someone. I was a, you know, a fool, a young fool.
Now, you were in Warhol's film, Chelsea Girls. Why don't you describe your role in that?
My role in Chelsea Girls was, first of all, the name was Hanoi Hannah, and it was taken from this woman who had a radio show during the war, and she would taunt the American GIs. But rather than being sexy about it, I think I was just basically brutal. Brutal beyond what a normal girl should be capable of, also intelligent, so that I sort of knew what was going on. And what Warhol would do is he would put a lot of people, you know, in front of a camera and then hope that something would happen. I knew what he sort of wanted to happen, and I would engineer it. And then, you know, people would fall into place. You know, if you had one strong person, you needed a victim. And so the victim would usually be found. And then, you know, you do what you can.
Your mother sued Andy Warhol after Chelsea Girls. Why? Because he didn't pay you? Was that it?
No, he didn't pay anybody. He was like Corman. He was the cheapest man in the world. My mother thought that... My mother always stood behind me. She said I was doing something artistic. I went to Cornell to be an artist. Now I was with Warhol. It did not matter to her that, you know, I was running around in skin-tight leather paraphernalia and drugged out of my mind. It was artistic. So she let me do all of these things. But the minute that I stopped showing interest, she suggested to me that I should get paid. And then... Morrissey came to me and he said he wanted me to sign something.
This is Paul Morrissey who made some of the films.
Yes. He said he wanted me to sign a release for Chelsea Girls. And I told my mother, she had always told me never to sign anything because she was afraid I was going to sign something communist, you know. So I told my mom and she said, no, 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 don't sign that and let me sue him. And I just, you know, I said, okay. So she sued him.
What came
out
of it?
She got $1,000 and she got his undying hatred. That's what came out of it. He hated it. He hated giving out money, especially in that manner. Of course, I'd hate that too. And that's when I started leaving the factory.
Were you embarrassed that your mother was suing on your behalf, or did you support her in the suit?
My mother is a very special person. I was used to her, you know, throwing a fit. In a restaurant, this certainly didn't embarrass me. My mother could never be controlled.
So you started leaving the factory after this lawsuit?
Warhol definitely got cool towards me after the lawsuit. And I was not asked to do movies anymore. I noticed that when I hung around the set of the 24-hour movie, I wasn't really asked to be in. I mean, the people would ask me, but Warhol wasn't behind it that much. And so I left. Started doing plays for Ronnie Tuvel.
You know, it's interesting to me that during this whole period when you were part of the Warhol crowd and, you know, you were performing with the Velvet Underground, your home was with your parents. You were still living with your... You weren't there every night, maybe, but that was still your home.
That was my home, yes.
So, you know, you'd go from this incredibly out there kind of scene back to your parents' middle class nice home.
Yes, and lucky for me, I did. Otherwise, I'd be dead. In other words, when you get high, you have to come down. When you go out, you have to come home. I had no money. I had to stay there.
Do you think this is part of the reason why you survived when so many of the Warhol people were casualties?
Absolutely. You can't get high without coming down. That's a myth.
So you really think you have your parents to thank, in a way?
Oh, of course. My parents were great to me.
What did you do with your life after leaving Warhol?
Well, for about a half a year, I just sat down and recovered.
Mm-hmm.
I had a tremendous addiction to get rid of.
And you got rid of it that quickly?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, in my family, you know, you just... my family is really strange, but, you know, you don't say anything. And the first thing I did was get very fat, and I just sat in my bedroom till that went away. It took about a couple of months. And then slowly but surely, I started being, you know, the next person, and went on a date all the way to Europe. And, you know, you start again. But my parents, my parents are the 50s, you know, they never mentioned that you've done something wrong. When I came back and sat in my bedroom, you know, for about 2 months, they treated it as if, you know, everything was fine, which was, thank God, because I couldn't explain what was going on.
Mary Woronov, recorded last year. Her memoir is called Swimming Underground, My Years in the Warhol Factory. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.